From the Moan Broadcast Center, this is Air Talk. Good morning, I'm Larry Mantle. The Boy Scouts of America is facing potential bankruptcy, the result of hundreds of lawsuits claiming child sexual abuse. More than 12,000 victims have been identified by a researcher hired by Scouting to investigate alleged abuse. If the nonprofit files bankruptcy, how would victims be compensated and how might Scouting's programs be affected? Boy Scouts of America, a true American institution, iconic throughout its history, but the future of the Boy Scouts of America appears much more complicated. Good morning. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Good to have you with us. Later this hour, LAPD Chief Michael Moore is with us to talk civilian review of officer discipline and a dramatic drop in deadly use of force by the department. But as for the Boy Scouts of America, sex abuse claims against Scouting multiply. The organization's reportedly considering bankruptcy. What would that mean to victims seeking financial compensation? And what would it mean for the future of Scouting itself? With us from the Associated Press, reporter David Crary, who's been reporting on Scouting for many, many years. David, it's good to have you with us today on Air Talk.
Glad to be with you, Larry. So thanks for having me on.
So let's talk, first of all, about, just to give a little context for this, when did Scouting itself, realizing that it was facing hundreds of claims of sexual abuse from adult leaders within Scouting, at what point did it decide it needed to try and determine the depth of abuse?
Well, the Boy Scouts amazingly have been aware of some potential for abuse problems since the 1920s. It turns out that that's when they began keeping confidential files of adult volunteers and staff that might pose a threat of some kind of molestation of young people. So they've been aware of the problem for a long time. What's changed is that the general public and families were not aware of that for decades. And only sort of in the 60s and 70s did these abuse cases start getting into the public consciousness. And in the 80s and 90s, the Boy Scouts started adopting very strong anti-abuse policies. So there was a time lag there. Now, for various reasons that we can talk about, the pressure of potential litigation is snowballing. And the Boy Scouts realize that the financial threat that they face is existential. They have not ruled out concerning bankruptcy. They know that their financial squeeze could be intense in the coming months.
And are the parallels with the Roman Catholic Archdiocese, where there have been many, many claims of abuse, is this a similar sort of financial pressure? Because if I'm not mistaken, some of those archdioceses also filed for bankruptcy.
That's correct. There are a lot of similarities between the Catholic Church and the Boy Scouts. One difference is that the Boy Scouts of America is a national organization. They're headquartered in Texas and have affiliates around the country, but it's a national organization. The Catholic bankruptcies, as I think you correctly mentioned, have been diocese by diocese. There's not been a bankruptcy by the Catholic Church of the United States. So as big as some of those Catholic bankruptcies have been, and I think one of the biggest was in the Los Angeles area, lawyers tell me that it would be dwarfed by the potential scale of a national Boy Scout bankruptcy. This would be a national organization with affiliates in every state having to figure out how to deal with its creditors and make some kind of payment to people who can prove valid claims.
I also wonder about the nature of the perpetrators of the abuse, because in the case of the Roman Catholic diocese, you've got the claims are typically against employees of the diocese, their priests or other teachers or people in the employ. In the Boy Scouts, are most of the claims against volunteers as opposed to staff members?
Exactly. You phrased that very well. There have been some claims against staff members. It's not that that has not happened, but the overwhelming majority of complaints have been against unpaid volunteers, adults of varying ages. Nonetheless, the Boy Scouts have a track record of reaching settlements and paying some sort of compensation, even when it's a volunteer. So I don't think that they're going to argue they don't have the liability because these are people that are volunteers rather than staff. So they're going to face that with large numbers of cases. Lawyers in several states are busy signing up clients by the hundreds this year because of changes in statute of limitation laws. And we can talk further.
Yeah.
That's one of the reasons for this larger threat this year is states are opening up windows for some of these victims of long ago abuse to file suits.
We're talking with David Crary, Associated Press reporter for a number of years, has been following the Boy Scouts of America, the financial claims against scouting of sexual abuse by volunteers and staff members over many, many years. In fact, scouting itself hired a researcher to look at their records going back to 1944 all the way up to 2016. And the researcher identified more than 7,800 suspected abusers, this from Scouting's own files, and more than 12,000 victims during this period of time. And David, the thought is that that may well understate the problem because these are, by definition, reported cases and don't necessarily get at all of the victims of the alleged perpetrators here. Can you elaborate on the numbers?
Yeah, that's correct. Several of the lawyers that I've been speaking with who are signing up new clients this year, especially in New York State and New Jersey, where the statute of limitation laws have been changed, they're telling me out of hundreds of clients that they're signing up that a large percentage of them are alleging abuse by Scout leaders who are not in the Boy Scout files. So if that pattern bears out, that would mean that 7,800 figure that you just mentioned could be significantly understated. None of us know for sure what the numbers will be, but it seems almost inevitable that there will be many more than 7,800 alleged or proven perpetrators.
I'd love to hear from Air Talk listeners your thoughts about scouting in the wake of this disclosure and the potential filing of bankruptcy by the organization. I know when we've talked about scouting on previous programs over the years, we've heard from so many listeners who felt that it was a very important part of formative years and look fondly on scouting experience. For others, some unpleasant experiences that have come out of that. So as you look at scouting in the larger context, the pros of the organization that you might have experienced or negatives you might have experienced, your thoughts about its future. We're at 866-893-KPECC. If you're a parent who's been a volunteer in Scouts in recent years, what do you think of currently the protocols that are in place to try and protect those that are in Scouting? Do you feel that it is sufficient? Do you think that the background checks that are now required and the reporting process of alleged abuse, that it's thoroughgoing enough to protect kids? 866-893-KPECC. David, talk about those protocols a bit more. What are the procedures in place to protect kids?
Yeah, I think that the Boy Scouts are correct when they say that they now have what are close to state-of-the-art anti-abuse policies. For example, now no Scout adult Scout leader is allowed to be alone with the boys, and now with the girls also, they've gone co-ed. Everything has to have at least two adult leaders. In fact, the policy is if there's only one adult around, cancel the activity. You can't go ahead. So that's clearly a strong step. They now have what they say are rigorous criminal background checks for all staff and unpaid volunteers. It took a while for them to phase that in. They consider themselves a role model now. They're trying to advise other groups. And they said just the other day that in 2018, last full year, out of 2 million-plus youth in scouting, they reported 5 incidents of sex abuse. So to the extent that that's accurate, it would show that they've made a dent in this problem that was pretty rampant a few decades ago.
And going back earlier, David, was the approach that they would put someone on a list if there was a complaint against them, but that there wasn't really a proactive process or an easy way for people to report abuse allegations?
Well, what they did not do for a long period of time, they did keep this confidential list. They tried to prevent the people on that list from like rejoining scouting elsewhere. They did not share this information with parents and families and people in the community. They say they reported it to law enforcement, but there's some question about whether that was always done. So there were some gaps in communication for a while that some of the victims are bitter about. They feel that if parents in the community had been warned, there would have been more awareness and possibly less abuse.
Well, I wonder if a part of the problem was that you had volunteers who would get the report about other volunteers, and they wouldn't want to in any way escalate this to potentially harm the reputation of the, you know, fellow parent leader. And so this stuff was kind of swept under the rug so as not to do that. And I wonder if in many of these cases, paid staff for the Boy Scouts didn't even get involved.
Well, you're hitting on something here. I think there was kind of a message from the National Boy Scout headquarters to their affiliates. Be careful about disclosing any of this information. There could be the possibility of libel suits, defamation suits. And I think that method probably did deter some local scout officials from being more outspoken about what was going on. That was pretty clearly one of the phenomena that was playing out at the time.
All right. Let's take a call from Paul in Redondo Beach. You've been a scout leader, and I understand that your kids are Eagle Scouts. Congratulations on that accomplishment. Paul, what do you think about when you were a leader about the background checks, the process for protecting kids? Do you think it was robust enough?
The background checks were fine. The problem that my kids had was they felt that they were atheists. And suddenly scouting went from camping and morals and learning about team building to suddenly they had to say, oh, yeah, we believe in God. And the shift largely because of the Mormon church became God, country, family, self. And when Baden-Powell brought it over from England in the early 1900s, that wasn't the focus. The focus was bringing up young men as mature individuals with a lot of resources, not all this religious element of it. So
yeah.
Even though they had background checks, that didn't necessarily protect kids in any way in terms of their own religious freedoms.
Yeah, that's interesting. Well, probably at that time, because religion was so much, you know, across the board culturally, less of an issue in terms of religious diversity overall. Paul, I appreciate your call. David Crary, was there a shift in the emphasis on faith in God?
You know, my impression is that's been kind of a fixture for virtually the entire Boy Scout history. It's always been interesting to me that as they changed policies for membership over the past 10 years or so, eventually agreed to allow gay boys into the Scouts, and then more recently going co-ed. They've stuck with the requirement that the Boy Scouts profess some kind of belief in a supreme being, and atheists have complained that they haven't opened up the doors to atheists. So there's been some changes in that, but atheists still feel excluded. So that's been a constant amid some other changes in membership policy.
David, I know you have to go very shortly, but I just wanted to ask you, if they end up filing for bankruptcy, would that likely not just have an effect on you know what potential money there'd be for payments to victims, but would that affect the ability of Scouting to operate and offer its programs?
The last part of that question, I think none of us know. Certainly the Boy Scouts are aspiring to find an avenue that would allow them to continue. I know that they yearn to stay in business. And I think their hope, if they file for bankruptcy, and this is what I'm told by bankruptcy lawyers, is that the Boy Scouts insurance companies would pay a lot of the compensation. The Boy Scouts, I think, would aspire to keep their camps and their physical holdings. For the plaintiff, the victims, I think they would get something out of bankruptcy, but perhaps not as much as if they were allowed to go to court on their own and sue. So it'll be interesting to see how it plays out, the extent to which the Boy Scouts can survive. I know they hope to. Probably my guess is that they would, but perhaps in some kind of smaller and more financially precarious way.
David, thanks so much for being with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you.
David Acrary is reporter with the Associated Press, who's been covering the Boy Scouts for many years. We're taking your calls at 866-893-KPCC from Bar Harbor, Maine. David, you're on Air Talk.
Hi, thanks, Larry. I appreciate you bringing this topic up. I was and still am a scout leader with my children, and I think it's a wonderful program, but parents need to talk to their kids, be involved with their kids, and pay attention to what's going on. I had the privilege of working with other great parents who care about their children, and even when parents can't be involved in scouting as a leader, to know what's going on and talk to their children as opposed to dropping their kids off and letting someone else raise them, so to speak. That happened some in the groups I was with. So
you felt like the parents didn't really spend any time with the volunteer leaders. They didn't really have a sense, which certainly is a good thing overall, but that wouldn't necessarily tell parents about whether it would be safe for their kids to be in the company of those parents, right?
True. And basically, in my scouting group, it was associated with the school and a church, and we knew the other people. We spent time with them. They were acquaintances or friends. And I think the two, what they call two deep leadership is very useful. But again, bad people can get in and try to break the rules, and it sort of relies on all of us to work together for the best of the kids. But yeah, parents, yeah, you need to know who your kids are going with, and certainly people can deceive parents. So communicating with your children and teaching your children, I think, is critical.
David, when you were a scout leader, was part of the orientation about what to do if there was an allegation of inappropriate conduct?
Yes. Yes, we got training in that. It became more clear and better done later on than when I first started with the program. But I had no qualms of going to the police if I thought something was going wrong, because in my view, it was kids first.
David, I really appreciate your input. Thanks so much. A scout leader for his kids in the Boy Scouts from Bar Harbor, Maine. David with us on Air Talk. Allison in Culver City, I understand you are a scout master right now. Do you feel like the Boy Scouts do a good job of preparing leaders for how to deal with allegations?
I do. I've just been trained in the last year. I actually have a new group of 28 girls that have joined Boy Scouts. And so I've gone through all of the training and seen the training that's required for all of the adult leaders who have joined my troop. And I think that's one of the things that changes my perspective versus the Catholic Church. I don't see the Catholic Church being proactive about how to deal with the situation of kids being harmed today. And I've been really impressed It was really intense, the training. It was the youth protection training is really difficult to watch, and they really want you to know what is expected and what you need to do. And there's packets that go out in every Scout handbook to new parents that they are meant to read with their kids to know what's to be expected of the troops so that parents are not surprised, kind of as your last caller mentioned, that parents and children should have that discussion and should know what's expected of the organization. And obviously it's on the organization to be doing its job, but they really try to interface with parents and make sure that parents are aware of the demands of leaders.
And Allison, I'm assuming when you say it was, I think you said difficult to watch as part of your orientation when this issue is brought up, I assume that's because they're showing potential scenarios that are just to think about a child being hurt in that way is just difficult to be sort of faced with that scenario.
For sure. And it could be triggering for people. And it also paints this picture that really predators are everywhere, which on a day-to-day basis is really, I think we all prefer to not think about. And the reality is that we need to look out for these kids. But it was just difficult to think of, you know, the evil that there is in the world.
Allison, also your thoughts. I know you wanted to mention about the religious aspect of scouting. How do you see that?
So I see what's written in the handbook and required is that a scout is reverent. And I think it's very up for interpretation. I think a scout troop in the Bible Belt with very religious leaders is going to be run very differently than a scout troop in maybe a liberal city. And I think what the wording is that the scout is reverent. I tell my scouts that it's about being reverent to something, that there is maybe something bigger than ourselves out there. I don't tell them anyone needs to believe in God. You know, it might be nature, it might be whatever, but it's just having a respect and maybe a sense that there is something bigger out there. But personally, in my group, I don't tell anybody what they need to believe or how they need to pray or how they need to act.
All right. Allison, thanks so much. Really appreciate you sharing your experience as sounds like a fairly new Scoutmaster, having just gone through the orientation part of the process. Also with us is John in Palos Verdes. John, I understand that you're an Eagle Scout and a Cub Scout Master as well. Congratulations on your Eagle Scout accomplishment. John, your thoughts on the organization?
Thanks, Mary. I grew up and had a wonderful scout experience. I never had personally a sexual assault issue. It was wonderful. I felt like I got a college degree before I even graduated from high school through the scouting program. Now being a Cub Scout Master, wonderful kids. And I'll say this, that there was a comment made by a poll over Donald Beach. I disagree with this aspect that you know, the scouts are now
John, I'm sorry we got a bad connection, but I'm going to pass on what you said, that scouting is grounded on religious faith. So in your view, perhaps the problem is that scouts are moving away from faith, and you think that it is integral in scouting that there is mention of God and that faith is a part of that. And you also, I know, wanted to make the point that you never had any exposure to any kind of sexual misconduct during your years in scouting. John, I appreciate that very much. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPECC. So good to have you with us as we talk about the future of the Boy Scouts of America in the wake of hundreds of lawsuits against the organization alleging sexual misconduct by volunteer leaders as well as staff members within scouting. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpecc.org. Momentarily, LAPD Chief Michael Moore with me to talk about a wide range of issues in law enforcement and his department generally. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Joining us on a regular basis, the chief of the Los Angeles Police Department, Michael Moore. Chief, good to have you with us again.
Good morning, Larry.
Let's start off with what's been a huge headline story over the past week or so, a huge seizure of guns at a mansion in Beverly Glen, 1,000 guns seized. I know this was a joint ATF federal as well as LAPD investigating this, but how uncommon is it to come across this number of weapons in one location?
Well, it's very uncommon. However, it speaks to really one of the emerging challenges that we're seeing here, both locally as well as across the country, and that is the dangers of individuals who are now, with new technology, manufacturing, if you will, weapons that are untraceable, what we call commonly known as ghost guns, and individuals who are using the abilities of access via the internet and other providers to garner the necessary parts and equipment, and then using their expertise, manufacturing very dangerous weapons, and then those weapons ending up on the streets and endangering the lives of all of us.
I'm glad you brought this up because I didn't quite understand in the coverage of this what manufacturing meant. Because there can't be a factory that's from scratch making guns. But so they order the parts and then assemble the guns on location. Is that what's alleged?
So there's that aspect of it. There's also the capabilities now with modern 3D printing to actually manufacture parts within your own home. So the history of this is that weapons 10, 20, 30, 40 years ago were often the means of which acquiring them was through dealers or licensed individuals or sellers, which vary across the country. For instance, in the state, a very highly regulated market, but just going across the border into Nevada or Arizona, you can purchase weapons off out of the back of a car on a parking lot at a gun show. So that has existed for us, and we've had strategies to try to interrupt that flow of weapons into our streets and the violence associated with those weapons. But more recently has been this ability to order parts online and the ease of just going online and finding parts manufacturers and sellers and distributors, and then collecting them via UPS postal services and other delivery services where an individual can, again, going back to a YouTube video or other instructional material, learn how to assemble, if you will, be a firearms manufacturer, and then selling those weapons to people, many of which have no right nor ability to own a firearm, and which is why they resort to these type of underground markets to purvey these very dangerous weapons.
So this, in the size of it, is bigger than what you're typically going to see. But it sounds like you've come across other smaller scale versions of this.
Absolutely. Again, not just our agency, but ATF, alcohol, tobacco, firearms, and explosives, as well as the Department of Justice here in the state of California. This issue of ghost guns and manufacturing and the development of these weapons as another source is one of our most greatest challenges. Firearms, licensed firearms dealers still, for the most part, are operating within the law and as they should. However, we also see that a major source of weapons continues to be homeowners and others who have weapons, who have firearms that are not securely positioned at a home or location, and then stolen through a burglary or a break-in or frankly just the carelessness of the owner, and if someone comes along and breaks in a car and finds an unsecured weapon. There's been laws to change that and so forth, but many guns here in Los Angeles now, the majority still continue to be weapons that are sold, that are stolen
and then
used in crime and then sold on the street. But increasingly we're seeing this ghost gun development as being another major provider.
In the ghost gun cases where they come to your attention, is this typically because someone drops a dime and tips you off to it, or are there other criminal activities perhaps around it that, you through a warrant gain access and find the guns that maybe you didn't know would be there? How do you find out?
Our best and most effective means is by people who are aware of individuals conducting these type of businesses or these type of operations and bringing it to our attention. They can do so anonymously. They can call Crime Stoppers as a toll-free number, and they can leave that information, and we will act on it. They can contact us directly. They can talk to any police officer. Those tips and leads is what has generally been has allowed us to to uncover these types of operations. We also have undercover operations and investigations techniques I won't go into here as an effort to prowl and understand in the gun market. And there is definitely a gun market in Los Angeles, a underground market. It's far easier to get a gun in this city on the underground market than to get a driver's license.
Joaquin in South L.A. writes on our page, the Bel Air gun seizure is a non-story. The guy had a federal firearms dealer license. Most of the guns were collectibles. You want to respond to that claim?
Well, again, we'll allow the prosecution of this individual to proceed through the proper channels of the court. I'm confident that while some of those weapons there, he may have a legitimate ability to have. I'm also confident that the investigation will show in court that he was involved in unlawful activities as well, and that those activities endangered the public here in Los Angeles.
Did the investigation begin with your department or with the feds?
It's a joint effort. Again, we're proud of our relationship with our federal partners. It's key here in Los Angeles that we don't really look at agencies and our efforts in policing as who's the lead, but really who are our partners in a joint task force to work together and use our collective strengths to keep our city safe.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us coming up. We'll talk about the disciplinary review with civilian panels, which is now part of the new protocols at LAPD. We'll also talk about the officer-involved shooting stats, which are down significantly last year, and the crime stat programs that are used by the department. What are the benefits that officers see when they're on patrol? What are the concerns that civil liberties organizations have about that statistical analysis? You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. Back right after a live update from Hedy Lynn Hurdies. You're listening to Air Talk on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Larry Mantle. Coming up in our second hour, Elizabeth Warren decided she's not going to go on Fox News Channel. Bernie Sanders did and got a big audience, much bigger than he got for town halls on CNN or MSNBC. So for Sanders, it looked like the right move that he went in front of the Fox News audience. But Elizabeth Warren says she's not going to do that. And in doing so, also fired a shot at Fox News. So we're going to talk about the strategies coming up in our next hour of Air Talk. We're also going to talk, and we'll ask the chief to cover his ears right now, crashing parties, sneaking into events. Have you ever done that? And what went right or what went wrong when you crashed a party or a public event? Not that we're encouraging you to do that, but we want to hear your stories. That's coming up in the second hour of Air Talk. Right now, LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us to talk about the top stories at LAPD and in law enforcement. Chief, one of the things that LAPD Union for the officers has had sought was having the ability for civilian review panels to look at officer discipline. Civilians, perhaps oddly to some listeners, tend apparently to be more lenient when it comes to discipline than when you have professional law enforcement that is responsible for that. Are you concerned about having civilians taking this on?
Well, yes, and I think the important aspect of that will be the selection of qualified members who make up now what will be the majority or the entirety of a tribunal board. Three individuals that presently are two sworn command-level officers of the organization and then a civilian selected by the Board of Police Commissioners. And that civilian, that third member was brought on in the aftermath of the Christopher Commission as a means of, at the time, bringing what was believed to be or asserted to be more objectivity, that the sympathetic views of the command officers were not delivering justice to the people of Los Angeles relative to the discipline of officers. And it was thought that that third voice, that independent civilian voice, would cause the command officers to ensure the rigors. Now, the LAPPL, and I respect the leadership there,
Police Protective League,
they've looked at the conduct of boards of rights over the last 30 years, and they believe that those command officers can be unduly influenced because they are active members by me, by whoever the chief is, and that their decisions can are made with the rearview mirror of worried about their success or their future. Each chief before me and my role today as chief, I pay little or no attention to those decisions in a sense of what command officers make. As you know, they have to look at the record. They have to come to determination based on their own review, and then find guilt or innocence. This change, which has recently occurred, and now the provisions have been set up by the city council, will allow all three members to be now civilians at the discretion of the accused officer. What's key here is as we evaluate that in the coming year to two period of time, which this is going to be evaluated and see what the outcomes are, is that the selection of those panelists be done stringently, that the individuals be thoughtful, demonstrated character, of values that are representative of the values of the organization, and a willingness to look at information fairly and to contemplate and come to a determination of whether an officer, the evidence by the preponderance shows that the officer did commit misconduct, these are serious matters, and the evidence is not there, in which case the officer should be found not guilty.
If you're going to have, is it three members of the panel, so three civilians?
Yes.
Where is sort of the expertise on policing then? I mean, you're going to have perhaps competing scenarios, the representative for the mm-hmm. for the officer or other staff member, and you're going to have the departmental perspective. But the actual decision isn't going to, at least in part, be made by law enforcement professionals.
So there's a couple different roles. This is much like a courtroom, and you have the three civilian members. Let's say those are the panelists, the board of right panelists. They'll have at their disposal a city attorney that can help give them counsel as to information on various procedural matters or how to interpret or how they should or could interpret evidence presented to them. They also have before them an advocate, that of the department representative, who's putting on the case, much like a prosecutor. And then, of course, what they have today is a defense attorney, generally, who represents the interests of the officer, the accused. What I'm hopeful for is to see the advocate role of the department improve by the ability to place a deputy city attorney, because presently we use line officers, sergeants, if you will, of the LAPD as our advocates. And I feel that now even more, it's even more important with three civilian members as a board of rights, that the advocate be a city attorney, an attorney who has the necessary background and understanding of law and of effective techniques to present information clearly and in a manner that these civilian members can interpret and apply against the standards of the organization. And presently, there's a bit of an imbalance with a defense attorney who goes to a law school for years to talk about hearsay evidence and various rules of evidence and so forth. And we have this this trial going back and forth. And I think there's a bit of an imbalance there that the command officers who sit on the panel can help interpret. In the absence of those command officers, I believe that the role of the advocate is even now more important, that they be a clear communicator who can articulate the basis for why the department has made these allegations and believes these allegations to be have proven. None of these cases go to court or go to this Board of Rights without my review of understanding whether or not there is a preponderance of evidence to support the allegations as presented. So these aren't not just willy-nilly, and these are not just something that are just happenstance that occur. These are cases that have, my view, the department has bore the burden and shown the ability to show sufficient evidence that the allegation as presented did occur.
All right. We're talking with LAPD Chief Michael Moore joining us on Air Talk. If you have questions for the chief, you can ask them on the Air Talk page at kpcc.org. You can also call at 866-893-5722. Chief Moore, the LAPD has had one of the highest officer-involved fatal shooting counts historically in the United States. There was a lower count last year, so share with us what you see as the statistical progress.
Well, first of all, the Los Angeles Police Department is the third largest police department in the country. So when we talk about the pure number of officer-involved shootings, part of this is the scale of our organization in relationship to the 4 million people that we serve, the 1.7 plus million encounters, the over 100,000 arrests. These are very large numbers. And when you recognize that 17,000 police agencies across the country, the average size is less than 50 officers to more than 10,000. Statistics and numbers can get can be a bit misleading if we don't dig deeper. However, we have, as a matter of pure numbers, seen high numbers of officer-involved shootings in comparison to New York, Chicago, Philadelphia, and Los Angeles County sheriffs. And 5 years ago, the efforts of the organization under then-Chief Beck and the leadership of the Board of Police Commissioners began a campaign of a series of policy changes, tightening of rules and expectations, deployment of added tools such as additional taser devices and other less lethal tools, the emphasis on de-escalation tactics, and really the improved accountability, and then lastly, development of body-worn video and other systems to improve transparency to show the public and to show our officers strategies in which to lower the instances of use of force and particularly deadly force, and how that can save lives and improve outcomes. What I'm proud of is that beginning in 2016, we began publishing an annual report on much of what I've just described, both what our pure numbers are, the facts, as well as the strategies and our tactics to try to improve and lower the number. You know, my desire as a chief would be to see zero number of officer-involved shootings or the number of times an officer has to shoot in defense of his life or someone else or her life or someone else. Yet I know it was a short 10-day period about a week ago in which three different instances officers were fired on by suspects, and one officer was gravely injured and fortunately will survive, it appears. But that night it was very perilous. So I don't know how I'll get there as in this violent society we have. But our commitment is to look at every instances in which an officer resorts to force or deadly force particularly and to lower it. This last year we saw the second lowest number of officer-involved shootings in more than 30 years. And I believe the report that we published talks about some of the things that we attribute to why we're seeing that reduction. I believe it's been, again, good policy. I think it's been increased accountability. I think it's been added tools. And I'm really proud of the men and women who have taken this on as a challenge to themselves to use deadly force as a last resort.
And you're not concerned, at least to this point, there aren't instances where you think officers should have fired and there was a negative consequence to them not using lethal force? Because that's also a risk, too, if officers hold off in using it and someone else is injured or killed as a result of officers being fearful of using lethal force.
Yeah, so you know, a decision to use deadly force by an officer is without question the most challenging and soul-searching aspect that's made in one of the shortest periods of time, in split seconds. Going in the dynamics of that is picking and selecting officers who have good moral character, who have the proper training, have the cognitive skills to have situational awareness and understand how to use the tools that we've given them to work as a team to safely resolve, and yet knowing that there's times in which they can't. And that split-second decision may be to resort to deadly force to save their life or someone else. I look at each of those instances, and I'm proud of the balance that our people take. There are instances in which we get it wrong. An officer will make a genuine and innocent mistake, and we will judge those accordingly.
LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us. We'll continue our conversation in 1 minute on Air Talk. LAPD Chief Michael Moore with us on Air Talk. You can ask questions on the Air Talk page, KPCC.org. Chief Moore, I wanted to ask you about an investigative APM reports that looks at the use of tasers to subdue suspects, and particularly at a newer model sold by Axon, the X26P, which is in data that's come back about it, she's shown to be less effective than some of the earlier models of tasers. Nonetheless, the department has purchased many of these tasers. What is the department's process for assessing the effectiveness of technology like this, and how does that then factor into your procurement process?
So in looking at tools such as a taser or beanbag shotgun or 40 millimeter, these are terms that we use. These are actual physical items that we use as we go about our work. It's like vehicles or anything, any other piece of equipment. We'll evaluate it, do comparisons, benchmark, and understand its strengths, its weaknesses. And in balance, is this a tool and is this the right tool with the right manufacturer for the purposes that we've identified it for? There's a product evaluation. Then there's reviews of that, and then periodically we'll look back and see how the tool is performing. And should we continue, should we increase it, or should we consider alternatives? The taser is a device that we have carried for nearly the entire 38 years that I've been with the organization. Has been a tool that's been evolving during that entire period of time. I'm well aware of the article. I read it. I participated and made some remarks, as did Commander John McMahon, relative to this stirrup, if you will, in the last 5 years. How has that tool and the X-26P, that latest model, which is now going to be replaced by yet another model, how has it performed in relationship to its predecessors? And I've seen this issue about its effective rate and it being just over half or 50% of the time. And that been a reduction from an earlier stat of 6 out of 10 times it proving effective. The reality of the matter is that that tool has never been 100% effective any more than any other tool that we've used. The tools that we use in law enforcement have to deal with the real world conditions and circumstances. And they help and they aid and they assist us in gaining compliance or achieving our objectives. And the taser is no different. The taser has been meant as an electronic control device to allow officers to have a tool other than a firearm to deal with a dangerous individual, to have a tool other than a steel baton to confront and overcome a person's resistance, to have a tool other than OC gas, a 40-millimeter beanbag, you call it. There's all types of tools out there. And as we look at each of those systems, they each have areas of strength and they have areas of weaknesses. And what we talk about in the use of the taser or any other device is that as an officer recognizes what are the values of the device, is that we pay close attention to how we utilize it, and we have a plan that recognizes it may not prove effective, and in which case we have to transition. The latest thing, and I'll close with this about the X-26P, is what the narrative hasn't talked about is that device, I believe, was created because of challenges of the X-26, the M-26, the previous model. And there was criticisms of those previous models of causing deaths, of leading to deaths of individuals in which officers utilized that tool. And changes were made within that model, I believe, just as a practitioner, that were meant to limit or minimize and further improve the survivability of that tool. Now, did that lessen its effectiveness? I believe it likely did. However, it still proved, even by our statistics, to be effective in far more times than it's not. And these captures of when it's effective and not effective also miss opportunities to talk about the times in which an officer simply displayed the taser and simply showed it, and the offender said, "Okay, I'm done," and they complied. Lastly,
can I just interrupt there?
Sure.
Do you have a sense of how often that the taser display ends the confrontation versus the taser having to be used?
No, it would just be based on anecdotal and my gut.
No one's really studied that. Okay.
No, you can collect statistics all day long and data points, but what I'm satisfied is that the changes in the last 5 years, for instance, with LAPD and the use of tasers is 5 to 6 years ago, we did not have everyone equipped with tasers. And we saw the number of officer-involved shootings higher. And we believe a portion of our reduction has been the fact that officers now can resort to tasers and not have to resort to deadly force.
So it sounds like you're willing to accept the somewhat less effective model of taser in exchange for fewer deaths caused by a more powerful taser.
Yes, and also the ability now to equip all my officers with tasers, all uniform officers with tasers, and they physically carry them, I believe has allowed us to resolve situations without having to escalate and use greater levels of force to include deadly force.
And you couldn't do that with earlier models? You couldn't equip everybody with them?
Well, we did not have the funding at the time. Had we had funding 10 years ago to equip all our officers, we would have with the earlier models. But the safety of that item is important, as is its effectiveness. And most importantly is that we constantly evaluate how does it fit into the complex manner of us going out and trying to deal with, at times, very violent and dangerous individuals.
Chief Moore, thank you as always. We look forward to your joining us next time. Thanks very much. Michael Moore, Chief of the Los Angeles Police Department. You're listening to Air Talk on KPCC. It's Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. Great to have you with us. Later this hour, have you ever made your way surreptitiously into a party or a public event? We're going to talk about crashing parties and events. We're going to hear listener stories. That's coming up later this hour. Not that we're encouraging illegal conduct, but might be interesting to hear what Air Talk listeners have done over the years. Well, right now we turn our attention to Democratic presidential candidate Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator, turned down Fox News' invitation to be one of its candidates in a town hall forum, such as what Bernie Sanders did just about a month ago. His town hall was in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and he had a few terse interactions with moderators Martha McCallum and Brett Baer.
Our question comes from Kathy Harrington. Kathy, what's your question for Senator Sanders?
Hi, Senator Sanders. Welcome to the Lehigh Valley. So my question is, the definition of socialism is just a society agreeing to work together and combining their resources to make sure everyone is protected and taken care of. How can you challenge the idea that socialism is bad in the minds of the public?
You might have asked them, not me. But...
is this going to be a constant thing?
No.
It
will not.
All right.
All right. You ask me fair questions, I will give you fair answers.
Thank you, sir.
That's the deal.
And you know, not everybody thought that I should come on this show.
And we appreciate it.
All right. Your network does not necessarily have a great deal of respect in my world, but I thought it was important for me to be here and have a serious discussion about serious issues. Sally asked a good question.
So CNN has done the town hall format, and it has not gone well ratings-wise, as CNN's actually seen the audience size go down for these events. Here, Senator Cory Booker of New Jersey, another Democratic candidate, does a CNN town hall moderated by Don Lemon. Here's a clip from Orangeburg, South Carolina.
So we're going to start off with our audience questions now. First one is Tawanya Herbert, a healthcare professional from Columbia. She's a supporter of yours. Tawanya, there she is.
Good evening.
Good evening, Tawanya.
So even though you have proposed legislation and policies that positively impact our country, moving forward, many people just want to defeat Trump in 2020 and are critical of your approach for campaigning on love and unity. What do you say to those people?
I am so grateful for this question because I do hear it from time to time, even from some of my friends. But let's just first say that we all agree about the urgency of this moment to beat Donald Trump. Now, you guys can applaud that, definitely.
Cory Booker, that was from late March's CNN town hall. With us from The Hill, media reporter Joe Concha. Joe, thank you for joining us. Fox News has been getting, got good ratings from the Sanders thing. CNN, not so for some of its candidates. What seems to be going on with these formats?
Well, it could be a matter of oversaturation in terms of CNN. They've done more than 20 town halls since the beginning of the year with presidential candidates, and Fox has done only a handful. You mentioned Bernie Sanders. He drew 2.6 million viewers for that town hall to Fox News. When you compare that to, say, Cory Booker, who you just played, he didn't even draw 1 million. It was 917,000, I believe. So it could be a matter of oversaturation. It could be a matter of there's a certain must-see TV kind of quality to a Bernie Sanders appearing on Fox News, because not a lot of Democrats obviously go on there as much as they do, say, on CNN and MSNBC, which could be deemed possibly more friendly territory. So At this point, we're seeing more Democrats signing up for Fox News town halls. Amy Klobuchar, Pete Buttigieg will be appearing in town halls coming up. And I think you're going to see more Democrats bucking the DNC. Remember, Tom Perez, the chairman of the DNC, said that Fox would not get any debates, primary debates, on their network, citing that the network could not be trusted in terms of conducting fair debates. I think we've seen, and Bernie Sanders would probably even tell you, that a Brett Baer or Martha McCallum or Chris Wallace is more than capable of asking tough, fair questions that would help Democrats in such a crowded field with 22, 23 candidates now vying for that nomination.
Joe Concha, media reporter for The Hill with us. Joe, before I let you go, how much of this differential in ratings is a product of Fox News Channel just expanding its lead over the competition? It's ratings dominant now.
It really is. And I think that Fox has benefited the most from CNN's struggles. CNN, since the Mueller report in April, for instance, lost 26% of its audience from the same exact month a year ago. In other words, April 2018 to 2019, a quarter of its audience is gone. I'm not sure if it's because perhaps CNN has gone more to the left. It's not as much of a news organization now as it is giving opinions that seem to be more left-leaning. And as a result, they're now competing directly with MSNBC, splitting that part of the pie, a picture of pie, right? And 20% is going to CNN and 30% is going to MSNBC. And then Fox has no competition on the other side, on the right-leaning side, and they're getting that other 50%. So it just seems to be a matter of people going where they want their beliefs validated. Of course, there are exceptions. And Fox doesn't have any competition right now, while CNN and MSNBC are competing with each other for the same audience.
Joe, as always, thanks so much for joining us and talking with us about the larger media landscape for these town halls. Thank you.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Media reporter at The Hill, Joe Concha, with us. Talk about it from a politically strategic perspective. Very pleased to have with us Sean Walsh, Republican political analyst. And Sean, though he's based in the Bay Area, actually with us in studio today in L.A. Thank you, Sean, for coming in. Always good to see you. And Matt Rodriguez, our local right here from the Southland, joining us, Democratic strategist. Matt, let me start with you as the Democrat here. You think Elizabeth Warren is making a good strategic decision by avoiding Fox and also by insulting them as she does it?
Yeah, no, which I'll get to in a second. I think, though, strategically, I think this is coming out of, you know, you're always trying to win a news cycle. And I think what's happening, I know exactly what they're doing right now. I bet at the Elizabeth Warren headquarters, they sent out the release. They probably worked on it. They said, we're going to tweet it out. We're going to do a whole bunch of press around it. And they're looking online and they're saying, what's our small dollar fundraising going on? And what are our analytics on Twitter saying? Are we trending? And if we amp up the rhetoric, and how is it working? And I get that. When you work in a campaign, you're sort of right in the middle of a daily fight and you're trying to win the daily fight. And I get it. That said, Elizabeth Warren is a different candidate than some of the others. She's a little more like Bernie in the sense that she's a policy candidate. Like, Elizabeth Warren's not really going to win probably on a large level of inspiration, or like, her path right now is saying, these are the things that I would do. She's very well versed on policy. She knows what she wants to do. She has a pretty good sense of where she'd like to go. And some of those voters on Fox News, they're not all like, once you call it a hate-filled organization, you basically designate everyone who's watching that show as that as well. So it's never a good idea to insult the voters. And Democrats tend to think, well, I'm not doing that. We're calling them out, and, you know, as if it's a kind of a protest vote. But at the end of the day, it's viewers who make up the demand for any type of television network. And I think she has a real case to make to some of those voters. And Sean and I were talking about this before, and she can be talking about the banks or credit card companies or college debt. Those are pretty universal issues that people are facing now, whether they buy into her prescriptions or not, I don't know. But if you can't win voters that you don't talk to. And so I get why she's doing it now. It'll get some press on Salons and Esquire and Slate, and they'll talk about how great she is. But those aren't her voters. And I do think some of these candidates need to be thinking more about voters and less about what Twitter says or what the Cognizanti says in some of the bigger cities in this country.
Of course, she would first have to win the primary before she'd even necessarily worry about Fox viewers. So
to some degree, although I think there are some Democrats, I think you'd be surprised. I think some people will watch that show, like, especially there are some real journalists on Fox. So Chris Wallace is a real journalist. And, you know, Brett Baer, some of these folks, you can spend. Look, I have no love for Fox. I don't like this whole journalistic thing anyway. I think anyone who's wasting their time watching Fox or MSN busy at night should find a hobby. But that's me, right?
But,
I work in the business. But at the end of the day, this is not the way media was when I was a kid, or God help me, Sean, who's much, much older than I am, remember? But you had 30, 40, 50 million viewers a night watching 60 Minutes, Walter Cronkite. It's not the case now. So these are a lot of micro audiences that people are going after. And there's a positive to that, in that you can find a niche and get yourself hooked in. But there's also a negative, which you spend all of your time. I mean, some of these stations are getting a million folks. That's not that many.
Yeah.
I think she should be talking to as many people as she can, because she, unlike a lot of the other candidates in this race, she actually has something to say.
Yeah, well, the same way it seemed like such a natural for Bernie Sanders to go on Fox.
I mean, that was same reason for him. I thought he acquitted himself fairly well. You're either going to buy to what they're selling or you're not. But she, again, she has policy prescriptions that she should be talking to people about.
Sean, so you think she's made a mistake?
I do. Fighting hate with hate. I mean, she says Fox is a bunch of haters, but she basically is putting the hate on Fox News. The other thing that I think is important to note is that I don't think Fox is per se the Republican network, and that MSNBC is the Democrat network. I think Fox tends to skew more conservatively and MSNBC more liberal. And there are a lot of Democrats, as we found out, that got Donald Trump elected to the White House who are conservative Democrats. And so that's an audience that she needs to talk to in a primary race. And if she were to be the nominee, it's an audience she's going to need to talk to as well to win the presidency. If you are too far to one extreme, and the Democrats have a bad history of this over the past 100 years, of when their candidates are just too far left, they can't self-course correct and come back to the center. And so I think it's a losing proposition for her, and a losing proposition for any Democrats who refuse to go on to an audience that's that large.
But one of the arguments you hear from Democrats is Trump has changed the whole ballgame with his bellicose comments, with his boorish behavior, with his insults of different groups and organizations, that sort of the way to fight back against that is to behave similarly. So when Warren makes, this comment that it's a hate-for-profit racket giving a megaphone to racists and conspiracists, I mean, that is sort of Trump-like, that sort of statement. So is that unjustified for her to go that far?
Well, again, I go back to fighting hate with hate. I don't think that sells at the end of the day. I also think that President Trump President Trump tapped into, at the time that he was running, I hate Washington, I hate the establishment. That happens in this country episodically. It just rises up, and he capitalized on that. I don't see, at least at this juncture, with the strongest economy probably in most sustained history, lowest unemployment for African Americans, Latinos, and the stock market's defying gravity, the president's not capitalizing on that and bringing a broader base in. So if he doesn't expand his base, he's not going to be elected. And I think Joe Biden, if you look at least what the polls are doing, I think he was initially going too far left, and he's tacked a little bit back more towards the center, because in the polls, if you look, Biden, if he's not the number one choice by other folks, he's usually the number two choice. And he's actually hurting Bernie Sanders with millennials, because they tend to still be with Sanders, but they're comfortable with the Biden. So I think that's the right approach. Play it with both sides and skew a little bit more to your party side. But that's a winning combination.
The other thing I've seen from polls of Democrats is that the majority, pretty strong majority, want a candidate who's going to win over one that they personally feel an affinity toward and are really excited about. They're excited about getting Trump out of office.
Well, and this is the challenge. I was having a conversation with a friend of mine, colleague, earlier this morning, who's probably skews further left than I did. But I said, in a vacuum, if you were going to vote right now, let's just say all of a sudden the presidential election is going to happen in the end of July. We're just making this up. And it's Trump. Who is the Democrat you would pick right now? Not who you like, not who you want to see. Who do you think can beat him if it's so urgent? And immediately it was Joe Biden. Because I think people think that he's the guy who can win. And why? Because they think he can put a couple of more states on the map. He's already crossed the threshold of being able to be president. Now, look, that doesn't mean that's where this is going to end up. There's a long way to go. Biden has proven over his 40, 50 years in politics to be somewhat of a brittle campaigner and problematic campaigner. So I'm not saying that this is a fait accompli. But if you look at what happened with Biden, when he got into the race, everyone was just like all of the New York Times editorial pages. There's Slates, and they're like, there's no way he can possibly win. I mean, this guy's like, he's like Anita Hill and busing and is touchy. It's all hard. He's gotten in, and he's gone up 30 points since he got in.
And again, polling shows when you ask about the Anita Hill and busing and all, it doesn't. It registers with news organizations and with young voters. Mm-hmm. They're more attuned to that. But the overall Democratic voter, those do not appear to be top of mind issues.
No, all the Democrats are not just on Twitter, are not just like, again, we've seen a consolidation in media. There's a lot more media in some ways, but there's just a lot of your writers are from their LAs and they're from New York and they're DC. And that doesn't mean they're wrong. It's just, that's just one sensibility. And there's just a lot of other voters who are, and you saw this with the Trump voters. It wasn't like they weren't aware of his foibles. They knew what had happened on the Access Hollywood. But as Sean mentioned, they liked his anti-DC rhetoric and they were happy that he was willing to go all the way with it. And no matter how much the press would say you have to be against him, they were like, we get what he's doing. We're just attracted to these parts of him and we don't like what Hillary's selling. And so I think we sometimes miss the voters as opposed to just what's the sort of media noise.
We'll continue. We're going to hear what Sean has to say about this. We're at 866-893-KPCC. I'd like to hear your analysis, not just whether you personally think right or wrong Elizabeth Warren should go on Fox or the other Democratic candidates, but strategically, does it make sense for her to do it, or did she make the strategic right move by labeling Fox as she did and refusing to be on one of the network's town halls? 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. We'll be back in 1 minute. Should Democratic candidates go on Fox News? It appears to have worked pretty well for Bernie Sanders with the town hall that he did. More than 2 million viewers watched that on Fox. It enabled him to be able to reach out to voters who might not have given him as much consideration as perhaps they will after hearing his presentation on Fox News. But my question for you is, do you think it makes sense for Democratic candidates, maybe for some and not others? Elizabeth Warren says she's not going to go on Fox and do a town hall. Do you think that makes sense for how she's positioning herself for her candidacy? Or do you think that it might be shooting herself in the foot by not exposing her policies, her ideas in front of the Fox News viewers? Joining us, media columnist for The Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan. Margaret, good to have you with us. You think Warren's making the right decision?
Well, I think she's making a decision that's not just about politics. I mean, it reads to me as a principled decision. You know, there undoubtedly is some politics in it, but I think that she has expressed, I know that she's expressed that Fox News is not a place that she wants to support and give credence to. And so to me, I think it's a principled decision that she's making rather than a sort of strategic political calculation.
Does that then, let's say that she became the Democratic nominee, does that make it difficult then for her to reach out and say, I'm also, you know, Republicans would potentially be your president, I would represent your interests, when Fox is the highest rated news channel, when significant numbers of conservatives do watch it? Does that sort of take her out of making the case that she could represent them?
I think she can represent the country without necessarily going on Fox News, which is a place that has fed falsehoods and conspiracy theories and, you know, refused to correct errors and, you know, has been a damaging force in our society. So, you know, I don't think that, you know, I assume that people who are conservatives, Republicans, and even Fox News viewers do know how to change the channel.
Okay, so your thought is that this wouldn't turn off Fox News viewers and that she wouldn't need any of those viewers to win the presidency?
I'm not really saying that. It may turn off Fox News viewers, but I think it's worth it to her. It seems like the case she's making is that it's worth it to her not to support what she sees as a damaging news network. So it's a, you know, again, you have to separate the political calculation from the sort of stance that she's taking, which is sort of part of her brand, you know, that she'll say the tough things and let the chips fall where they may.
All right. We're talking with Washington Post media columnist Margaret Sullivan joining us on AirTalk 866-893-KPECC or the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. John tweets at AirTalk regarding the whole conversation about Fox News. I hope we can all at least do away with the false equivalency that Fox News is right-leaning like CNN or MSNBC is left-leaning. Fox News is a propaganda machine like no other network. Please acknowledge this. Sean, your response to that?
Well, look, so we have this wonderful thing in this country called the First Amendment. There are probably a number of Republicans who feel about the Washington Post as Ms. Sullivan articulated about Fox News. They probably feel that they're, you know, anti-American in some respects. I don't feel that way. I think the Post is a fabulous publication. But they're entitled to their particular perspective, as is Mother Jones, as is KPFA, as is any other media outlet in this country. And we have a history of actually, it's interesting. Our media networks and our media outlets are much closer aligned philosophically and ideologically as they have been historically in this country. There's nothing wrong with it. And so people can't. I don't like people getting only their news from one source, but welcome to America. They're entitled to that.
All right. Margaret Sullivan, you want to respond to me? Because I think Sean makes an interesting point. The Washington Post has sort of, you know, carved out this identity as sort of, you know, resisting Trump, and that's sort of become part of the Post brand now. So is that not necessarily a propaganda machine, but certainly it does put it in a particular category versus an elected official?
Well, I don't think that is our brand. And my boss, Marty Baron, who's, I think, the best editor in the United States, bar none, and I don't just say that because I work for him, but, you know, if you've ever seen the movie Spotlight, you've seen him there, has said, we're not at war, we're at work. And my rejoinder or my sort of agreement with that is it's not resistance, it's reporting. You know, we're doing the job of digging down. And if that ends up at times, you know, making President Trump unhappy, so be it. But we're not out to get him or to wreck his presidency or something like that. I reject that notion.
We're talking with Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for The Washington Post. Let's take some listener calls. Let's see. Let's talk with John in Culver City. John, what do you think? Does strategically it make sense or just the moral position, as Margaret Sullivan is saying, for Elizabeth Warren to not be willing to go on Fox?
Well, I do not think it strategically makes sense because she's not going to be the presidential candidate. She has a very good shot, however, at being the vice presidential candidate. Now, what that will allow her to do is if she was to go on Fox, it could help her brand and her image. As you said, she riles people up. She challenges people. And it would give her an opportunity to solidify the base for Biden and also have a legitimate vice presidential bid. By not doing that, she comes off as just afraid to come off of her talking points.
All right, John, appreciate your call. Sean, your thoughts about that?
Well, I've actually had a dinner with Elizabeth Warren, and I agree with what Matt had to say earlier. She's very, very bright, very knowledgeable on subject matter issues, and I think she can handle it herself just fine. I also think that for a number of Fox viewers, they tend to be very conservative. Some of they're pro-business, but they're pro-more small or medium-sized business. They're highly suspicious of Wall Street, and they think that Wall Street made out like bandits in the last economic meltdown. So I think she's got a message that she could walk away from there hanging her head high that she did fine. I think the Democratic Party is making a mistake by the chairman himself by declaring war on Fox News. I mean, the bottom line is they don't have to beat Fox News. They have to convince conservative Democrats and enough of their own party members that Donald Trump is bad and they need to put somebody else in their place. They don't have to have a war with Fox News.
But, Matt, I think Margaret brings up a really good point here that Elizabeth Warren may well be taking a moral stand,
yeah,
that she believes Fox is so pernicious,
yeah,
essentially in league with the president, propping him up,
yeah,
not looking fairly at evidence against his leadership and presidency.
Yeah.
And so even if she's going to take a hit for not by appealing these people, mm-hmm, she's doing what's right.
Well, it could be. Maybe it's because Sean and I've been in this business so long that very few politicians who get to this level are not doing something with a pretty specific calculation in mind. So maybe she's right. I find that hard to believe. I think most of these things are made at the end of the day. You can't affect change if you don't win. And right. And so I think to sit there and say, well, she's making a moral decision. Maybe again, I can't tell you what Elizabeth Warren is thinking. I think what she is thinking, it seems a little more clear to me, which is that I think she thinks that she's sort of getting into a lane of the anti-Fox News. It's a way to kind of win the news cycle. That strikes me as much more. Just a quick riff on this. I think a challenge is not just – it's just not a matter – I think the way this conversation is easy to go is to say, like, she's just going to talk to conservative voters. They're going to agree what she has to say, and they're going to vote for her. I think the larger issue is – and Sean may disagree with this, but there's been some polling recently. Republicans are less willing in some ways to compromise. There has been some polling on that. There's been a lot more on Democratic side. If you look at it, once you get past the kind of are they liberal or are they conservative, there's been more saying I want my elected official to maybe compromise with something in order to get things done, because Democrats are more institutionalist and they're a party of government. And our government works on some level of compromise, even though there's factions within both parties that are inflexible and are like, don't compromise. So when you won't go on Fox News, even beyond whatever substantive policy prescriptions she would have, it is a message to say, I'm willing to work with everybody except for this group over here. And once you start picking and choosing whom you will or won't work with, it makes our system difficult to work with because we're a compromise-based system. So I think it's a larger messaging negative and problem that she's got there, saying, I'm just not going to work with these people and these people aren't worth working with. That's a problem in our system.
Well, it's interesting because Bernie Sanders directly addressed that in the clip where he sort of, you know, said, I have problems with you guys at Fox in their own town hall, but it's like the greater value for me is talking with these people in this format.
Yeah, in order to get your message out to say, because at the end of the day, you're never going to get 100% of what you want in our system. We're not a parliamentary system. So I think that's a mistake she's making. Okay. Just from a macro messaging point of view.
Yeah, Sean, what do you think?
Well, Bernie Sanders did criticize Fox News, but I will tell you. So,
yeah, but sort of like the higher good of being.
But the higher good. I mean, there's a lot of Republicans who really absolutely despise NBC, and it's not just Rachel Maddow and NBC, but across the board on the way that NBC treats Republicans. And so, you know, if you have Republicans all of a sudden saying, "I will never do anything on NBC," I just think that's silly and nonsensical. I also agree with Matt too. Insofar as a winning formula historically in this country, absent having some weird dynamic where there's a groundswell for throw the rascals out, is to triangulate like Bill Clinton did and bring people in, not keep people out.
Yeah. Elaine in Porter Ranch in the San Fernando Valley, I understand you're a Democrat. What do you think of Senator Warren's decision?
I really like Senator Warren, and I think it's unfortunate because it makes me not want to vote for her. It makes me feel like if her goal is to reach everyone, then she might not enjoy it, but Fox News is the way conservatives get their news. And to me, if you're taking a moral stance and not going on Fox News, you're appealing to the people who will already vote for you.
Elaine, I appreciate it very much. Margaret Sullivan, media columnist for the Washington Post. Your thoughts about Elaine, a Democrat who likes Senator Warren but doesn't like the decision.
Well, I guess what I would say is I wish that Elaine would consider reading a fabulous piece that Jane Mayer wrote for The New Yorker magazine recently that really explains what Fox News is all about and what they've done and gets underneath the surface. And, you know, once you know that, I think that you would understand her decision making a little bit better. I mean, it's not. You know, yeah, a lot of conservatives watch it. I get that. But it's also sort of like saying, yeah, I'm basically okay with who they are and what they do. So, you know, I understand that this is a group that we've got here that's, you know, very focused on strategy, and that's fine. But I actually think there is a question of principle here, and I think it's absolutely fine that she's done what she's done.
And from the opposite direction, you know, Sean Walsh was talking about for Republicans who feel that MSNBC doesn't play fair with them and is in league with Democrats. You know, if they feel that way, do you think that then Republicans going on MSNBC is essentially endorsing MSNBC's the way that they cover elected officials and races?
Is that directed at me?
Yeah, it is. Yeah, Margaret, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know who said it a little bit earlier, but I think that is a false equivalency to say that MSNBC is the Fox of the left. I mean, there's no question that it is that it leans left, it's left of center. I think Fox is a whole different thing. I think that it is not really at its heart a news organization, but actually a propaganda outlet and something very close to state TV because it is so inextricably entwined with the Trump administration.
Amanda in Silver Lake, agreeing with you wholeheartedly, says it's admirable that Senator Warren has taken the stand with Fox News because it's about time we stop normalizing networks that rely on extremist propaganda. You can share your comments on the Air Talk page, kpcc.org. We're going to continue this conversation. So many listeners want to weigh in. We're going to take this for the rest of the hour. We'll be back right after a live update from Hetty Lynn Hurdy. Well, I'd asked you earlier this hour if you could get your best story of crashing a party or public event, but I'm sorry we're not going to be able to take that on today because the phone lines are smoking with listeners who want to weigh in on Elizabeth Warren's decision to not take part in Fox News Channel's town hall series of Democratic presidential candidates. Unlike Bernie Sanders, who had a big rating and by all accounts did very well in front of the Fox anchors who asked questions of him and the live audience at the Pennsylvania town hall. Our question for you is Senator Warren making the right decision, either strategically or as a principled stand on her part, or is it a mistake for her to avoid Fox and to verbally lash out at the network's practices? 866-893-KPECC. We'll be doing the Party Crashers segment probably sometime next week. So keep your story there in your memory banks ready to go. Let's continue with one of our many listener calls. Aaron in Tarzana, what do you think about the senator's decision?
Well, I disagree with it. She is a professor. She should be able to talk to the broadest audiences possible. She wouldn't discriminate against a student that she knew that would disagree with her. She should be able to reach out to the broadest audiences. And as far as a matter of principle, that is very good to take a moral stand once she's elected. But I think a political stand is much more prudent at this point in time.
All right. And Aaron, you know, one of the things that we were just talking about, Margaret with the Washington Post was saying that, you know, it's kind of an endorsement of Fox if you go on it. Do you see it that way or that someone can go on
that way with people that already endorse Fox? And I'm not saying she's going to change, and she should be getting a lot of, you know, she may be getting a lot of hate email as a result of it. But also, I think she's reaching out to a broader audience, and she may not change a lot of minds, but she may put question, she may question a lot of people's point of view to maybe have them think again about some of their ideas, because a lot of people watch Fox News. I watch it occasionally to balance MSNBC. I prefer MSNBC. But I'm saying that it has such a broad outreach that she's going to be reaching more than just hardcore right wing.
All right. Aaron, I appreciate it very much. And presumably with more than 2 million viewers watching Bernie Sanders, presumably, Matt, there are a fair number of Democrats who tuned in to see him on Fox.
Yeah. Independents, Democrats. You know, it's a big country.
Well, in the fish out of water thing to see a guy sort of in enemy territory.
No, exactly. And I think Warren, who is pugnacious by nature, and I think people like that about her. And the other issue that she's got is she actually knows her stuff. So I'd actually like to see her go kind of toe to toe a little bit and take a whack at some of this stuff, because she can be compelling on the stump. And she does, as the caller mentioned, she is a professor. So she's got a serious intellect, and she likes to kind of mix it up a little bit. And I think voters are looking for a little bit of passion and giving you an opportunity to demonstrate that. Because when you do demonstrate passion like she's doing here, it's in a vacuum. It's kind of easy to be outraged when it's on Twitter. It'd be kind of nice to go a little. I think sometimes people like to see people go and kind of back and forth. And she's got that written all over her. So I have a lot of respect for her. I just think it's politically a bad move.
And she is so good in front of an audience.
Oh, she's
and
very
she's
compelling.
Improved dramatically since being elected to the Senate. She's so good in front of an audience. Yeah. I think there's just great interest in seeing her, you know, go into that environment. But Ben in Silver Lake, your thoughts about Senator Warren's decision to avoid Fox News?
Actually, kind of piggybacking on what you guys were just saying, I think that it would be really smart and interesting for her to go on Fox News now, because it would make fantastic television. They would definitely have her on. I would think they would definitely ask her about this. And what she could do is she could basically bring receipts for whoever she's talking to of situations where they have been sort of disproven or whatever, or they've gone overboard. She could confront them directly and also have an opportunity to talk about her policies. I think Democratic primary voters would love that. And it would go viral, and it would probably raise her profile and could actually give her more of a shot at, getting some eyeballs and getting some votes in the Democratic primary.
Ben, appreciate your call. Sean, your thoughts about that?
Well, I think it's not a bad strategy or idea, but the way she went after Fox News, making it a moral issue, and the way that Ms. Sullivan presented it, which I fundamentally disagree with Ms. Sullivan's view, but they've made these moral issues. So if you all of a sudden turn on your own morals and then you go something else for political gain, that hurts you much, much deeper.
So you think she's sort of the commitment is now there.
She's boxed herself in.
Well, yeah. It's hard to call it a hate-for-profit network and then turn around and go on it, because it would get big rate. I mean, it just would be – I don't think there's a – I mean, I get what the caller's saying. I agree with him in a vacuum, but I just don't know how you could possibly do it now.
All right. Let's talk with Chuck in Azusa. Chuck, what do you think about Senator Warren staying off Fox News Channel?
I'd love to see her appear. I'd love to see her handle herself, to see how she responds to people who may have an opposing view, and how she handles herself under pressure, and if she takes it personal and begins attacking, or if she stands her ground and expresses her views. And then secondly, I believe that Fox is like CNN, CNBC, and the other cable networks. They're primarily about commentary. If you really analyze read the scripts of the programming, it's pretty much about commentary. So to say one newscast is better or worse than another, I think is a fallacy. And the idea of brand, if the Post thinks that their brand is something, or Fox, the fact is it's what people think of a brand, regardless of what the entity thinks their brand is. Thanks.
I appreciate it, Chuck. Chuck and Azusa. Cardi2020 tweets at Air Talk, "She's brilliant." Speaking of Senator Warren, "As long as they have talk show hosts, they're not journalists," she says, "peddling conspiracy theories and lies. Fox News," in quotes, "is not legitimate. They can attend her town halls and ask questions there." 866-893-KPCC. Gary in Echo Park said, "As someone who has nothing positive to say about Fox News, I can't help but wonder if she missed an opportunity to do something like what Jon Stewart did on CNN's Crossfire several years ago." For those of you not familiar with that, Jon Stewart went on as a guest on Crossfire, which is this sort of hot take, two people of opposite sides. They sort of agree what they're going to argue about every day and then yell at each other. And Stewart went on the show and sort of upended the whole premise of it, saying that the program itself was corrosive to democracy and to rational public discussion. And he essentially criticized both of the participants for you know, being a bane of public conversation, which is a kind of an interesting thing. And it got far more attention than any criticism Stewart could have said on The Daily Show about how Crossfire. You're nodding your head, Matt.
I was going to say, if you're Warren and you – again, Ms. Sullivan doesn't think it was political. I think it's political. So you think you're getting a little bit of a hit right now off of attacking Fox News for the people who like it. Okay. What would be better as if you got an actual viral hit as you went on? Like, no one's saying going into the belly of the beast means you go on there and say, "You know who I really like? I really like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson." Like, no one says she has to do that. And I think you're much more likely to get a viral moment or something that's compelling out of a scenario in that type of atmosphere than it is sort of in this vacuum kind of, you know, ranting and raving about what a hate-filled machine Fox is. And the Stewart thing, I remember that when that came out. That was it. Yeah. People were like, "You got to turn this on. This is unbelievable." It's enormously compelling, and it's still compelling even watching it today, as well as prescient, even if you watch it today. But I think she's much more likely to come out of something that will be it will be helpful to her campaign and will sort of raise her profile than anything just kind of doing this through Twitter and through a couple of a couple of press releases.
Eisman tweets at Air Talk, "Warren's comments about Fox reminds me of Clinton's basket of deplorables comment that turned out to be very damaging." Let's talk with Jeff in Hancock Park. Jeff, I'm a little tight on the clock, but please go ahead with your comment.
Absolutely no. She just shot herself in the foot because she, you know, shows that now she can't work with both sides. You know, as a president, you can't, you have to be able to put away, you may disagree with them, but you can't control the narrative when you're not there. So if she's not able to, now they're free for all on her and she can't be able to control or be able to change people's minds by her talk.
That's interesting. Yeah. So your argument is sort of that in her absence, the void is filled by negative commentary about her. Sean, just quickly, do you think that how she's treated on Fox might be different if she took part in a town hall?
I do. Look, people like man bite dog kinds of things that happen. So I think she could go on to a Fox type of program and then provide something that's reasonable. Same thing if a Republican went on to like an MSNBC type of program, challenged rabid Democrats who are abortion on demand always, and then came up with a reasonable abortion policy. People are not uniform on all their policy issues. So you come there and then you have a memorable moment that helps you break through against the 20 odd other people. The Republicans could do the same thing with same-sex issues, gender equality. There are ways to do things to go in front of that audience that, in my view, then is a lasting news story. You can make mistakes that can hurt you, but it also helps propel you into a unique area. So I think it's an opportunity, and it's an opportunity lost on her part.
So Pete Buttigieg, he's going to go on Fox and do a town hall. I think Amy Klobuchar, if I'm not mistaken, is going to do one on Fox News as well. We're talking about Elizabeth Warren, the Massachusetts senator's decision not to take part in one of the Democratic presidential town halls on Fox News Channel. We're at 866-893-KPCC. Back in 1 minute. Great to have you with us on Air Talk. I'm Larry Mantle. We're talking about Senator Elizabeth Warren's decision to forego an appearance on Fox News Channel's Democratic presidential candidate town hall. And she fired a shot against the network, saying the news channel is a hate-for-profit racket that gives a megaphone to racists and conspiracists. We're talking about both the decision and her statement about Fox News Channel. By the way, coming up just a few minutes, Terry Gross in a reprise of her 2012 interview with Doris Day, who passed away this week, and also part two of her conversation with Howard Stern, whose new memoir is out about his dramatic personal change after undergoing therapy. That comes up on Fresh Air with Terry Gross in just a moment. We have, Greg in Santa Monica says, the fact that Senator Warren calls Fox News a hate-filled propaganda machine feeds into the same national ideological division that she's been critical of when Trump says similar things. With us is NPR's media correspondent and host of NPR's On Point, David Folkenflik. David, thanks so much. Your thoughts about Senator Warren's decision to forego Fox, do you think that hurts her?
Well, there are ways there that it does and there are ways it probably won't. You know, you can think about this in three separate ways. In a sense, although she uses pretty tough language, she's taking a principled stance. That is that although I think there are some terrific journalists who work at Fox, the larger point of Fox writ large is not to treat Elizabeth Warren and the Democrats fairly. It's just not. While they do have some journalists who may have their own motivations to try to do that, that's not what Fox is about. Fox is in the business of feeding a certain kind of narrative and to try to influence the discussion, particularly in the Republican Party. The second way to look at it is she's, you know, basically siphoning herself off from Democrats or independents who might get to vote in Democratic primaries, who do watch Fox News and who do take seriously what they see there, even if they view some of the opinion stuff or some of the commentary at a discount. And so she's shielding those folks off. The third thing, and this is something that guests may have said, forgive me if I didn't hear it, but the third thing is that it seems to me as though she may be talking you know, particularly in a, what is it, 22, 23 candidate race at the moment in the Democratic primary, she may be talking to a pure, more distilled Democratic or progressive voter for whom this message may be something of a rallying cry and a unifier. So she may be aiding her cause in a narrow sense, in a way where in a more narrowed field or in a general election, she might be hurting herself by cutting herself off from voters she might need.
All right. David Folkenflik, NPR News Media correspondent with us. Let's talk with Lupita in Glendale. What do you think of the senator's decision?
Well, I think Elizabeth Warner has certainly thought about conservative positions. However, going on with people who are not journalists, who are not really there to agree on facts, et cetera, I think is fine. She can certainly seek out other venues, other conservative voices, and discuss the issues. If she wrote an op-ed and was asked to have it printed in the Inquirer, nobody would question how sensible that decision would be. She would put her op-ed in any other traditional newspaper. So to me, Fox News is like the Inquirer. There's so much untruth being promoted as fact. I think she's right. Why be part of that?
Lupita, I appreciate it very much. Just one important distinction to make in those town halls, the three that ask questions, I think are generally well regarded in journalism and are not looked at like a Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, the prime time hosts, who, as you describe, are, I mean, they're doing conservative commentary. That's not really news coverage. Lupita, I appreciate your call very much. Sean?
So what if you go on with Sean Hannity, Laura Ingraham, and Tucker Carlson? I mean, that's they represent or focus a certain level of the country. Again, I think it's an opportunity, not a negative. It's an opportunity when you're going against people to amplify issues that she believes are extremist or wrong, and it gives her a bigger microphone and a bigger platform. So, you know, again, I think it's an opportunity lost on her part.
Let me share some more listener comments. Juliet tweets at AirTalk, good for her. Let's not legitimize Fox. Thomas tweets at AirTalk, I would see it this way. Fox is going to make a caricature of me regardless, but maybe some old guy or gal is hate watching Elizabeth Warren on Fox and seeing her not as some crazy socialist, but a person with reasonable ideas. You can share your comments via Twitter at AirTalk or on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Kuby writes on the page, in this age of increased political polarization, Warren is only further dividing the country as she seeks to stand out from other presidential hopefuls. Very bad strategy. I can think of no way this will help her in the long run. You can share your comments again on the AirTalk page, kpecc.org. Bill in the San Gabriel Valley says, if Pete Buttigieg goes on Fox, he is, by the way, Bill, I dare someone to ask him about how being gay is sinful and against God's will. I'll enjoy seeing how he addresses that. Sean, you were talking about this with us during the break, actually. How do you think Buttigieg ideally would present himself on Fox?
Well, I think Mayor Pete's presentation, his counter to Pence, that God made him that way and he's one of God's children, was brilliant. And I think, were it me and I were his campaign strategist, I would have held him hold back there, wait until the Fox moment, deliver that line. That would be a memorable line that would have spread all across the country. So, as I say, it's an opportunity for folks to present in a form where there's a perception that they're all one area, but there are reasonable people across the spectrum that are listeners and viewers of that network. And I would have done it there.
All right. Sean Walsh, Republican political strategist, joining us in Southern California today. And great to have him in studio. Matt Rodriguez, Democratic strategist. Thank you so much for coming in and spending overtime as this took off into an hour-long segment. And, of course, thanks to NPR media correspondent and host of NPR's On Point, David Folkenflik, who so kind to join us so regularly, often at the very last minute, as he did today. David, always appreciate it. Thank you so much. And Margaret Sullivan joined us, media columnist for The Washington Post, again, similarly coming in at the last minute. We appreciate her generosity of time. Have a great afternoon. Fresh Air with Terry Gross is next. And talk about two opposite guests, Doris Day, a reprise of the 2012 interview Terry did with her, and Howard Stern. How's that for something completely different? Have a great day.